I think the happiest opportunities for those of us who travel about in the interests of the society and sharing ideas with fellow members is indeed the occasions when we can meet together as members. And so it is with real happiness that I am here and speaking to you and sharing with you some thoughts. But first of all, want to bring you the loving and affectionate greetings of the entire family of the Crotona Institute of Theosophy, a Theosophical Center in Ojai, California, as many of you may know, which next year celebrates the 60th anniversary of its establishment as a Theosophical community and educational center. It is in a period of rather rapid expansion and development, and I think is fulfilling very much the purposes for which it was founded and was given impetus by the late, great Dr. Annie Besant. And indeed, it was her vision, along with that of the founders of the Crotona Institute, A.P. Warrington, who served as vice president under Dr. Besant, and Miss Mari Poots, who was head of the Esoteric School of Theosophy for so many years in the United States, that the Crotona Institute was established in that very special Ojai Valley, which is indeed a place, we are told, of the future, and one feels that very, very much. So I want to bring you the loving greetings of all of the family that are known as the Crotona family at the Crotona Institute of Theosophy. And of course, one of your own members is part of my staff, indeed my right hand as the assistant in the teaching field and with the resident student program there, Diana Dunningham, who I know is thinking of us very, very much since she said, "You, if you're going to Australia, you have to stop in New Zealand." So she's partly responsible, you see, urging me on to this. Didn't need much urging because I love coming back to New Zealand. Well, I've talked in many circumstances, but I guess I've never talked across a billiard table before. And I hope all of you are mindful of the rules behind me, particularly the first one, no hard shots. Just keep that in mind, please. However, since this is not a public audience, I don't have to worry quite as much because I think, you know, theosophists, we're rather soft shots anyway, so it doesn't really matter. Well, now that you've laughed a little, the psychology of happiness is perhaps that laughter, that lightness which we should have. All of us, of course, are, I suppose, seeking happiness. We do want to be happy. We want to feel happy. We want to feel that joyousness, that spirit of harmony. Tomorrow in the workshop, I want to address myself a little more to that under what may be a rather provocative title, So You Think I'm Unbrotherly. None of you, of course, ever act in any unbrotherly way, but we'll discuss it anyhow. And I can always, you see, refer to my own country, and you probably will then never want to visit the United States because you find that we live a kind of different sort of life. But anyway, I invite you to come and see, anyhow. But happiness means many things to many people, doesn't it? We can look at some statistics, for example, and while certain ones of these are drawn from the United States and others are drawn from statistics that have been published in England and for Western Europe, I rather imagine that New Zealand is not completely exempt from this kind of situation. We are told, for example, that in 1 year, the American public consumes 45 million aspirin tablets daily. Each night, it swallows 20 million sleeping pills, chasing them the next morning with an equal number of wake-up pills. We are told that today the rate of mental illness in Western Europe is rising at such an alarming rate that it is estimated that by the end of this century, one out of every 10 children born will suffer some form of mental illness during his adult life. We may well ask if the hallmarks of our civilization are the psychosis and the neurosis. We're suffering from a gigantic headache. Well, as theosophists, as students of this ageless wisdom, what is our response? Are we among those with this giant headache, with the need for aspirin tablets every night and sleeping pills and wake-up pills and tranquilizers and drugs and all the rest of it? What is our answer? The advances, of course, in physical knowledge, our knowledge of the world, our advances are tremendous, unparalleled, as we well know. Certainly, anyone who has lived any number of years at all, even a quarter of a century, 25 years, knows of the remarkable advances that have occurred in our knowledge of the physical universe. The scientific breakthroughs that have come in nearly every field of human endeavor, every area, astronomy, physics, biology, the control of outer nature, even weather satellites, the control now of the genetic code so that we can produce, you know, we can produce giant rats. These have already been produced in laboratories. I have to stop, and I think that's the way you say it here. We say laboratories, but I'll try my best to say so you will understand what I'm talking about. But these have been produced, you see. So with the idea that you can produce then the kind of human being that is physically that we determine, the genetic code is known. What are we doing about it? In the human sciences, and this is where I think we have a very special responsibility, in the human sciences, our knowledge is tragically small and limited so far as the world is concerned. We're stirred, of course, by perhaps a vague uneasiness that we really don't know ourselves. Even when we have studied the theosophical literature and we become familiar with the septenary nature of man, and we're very adept in, you know, diagramming it, putting it on blackboards, man ending up as a kind of layer cake with not much filling in between, except perhaps where the head belongs. But this is our ability. We know the books, we know the concepts, and we leave them there. But what do we do with them? Are we really aware of ourselves? Do we really know ourselves? Are we really understanding who we are, what we are all about? We certainly have a foreboding that unless we make peace with ourselves, and peace among ourselves, we will scarcely be able to have peace in the world. And certainly, if peace is equated with happiness, then we recognize that if we are not in some way happy, with an inner happiness, and I want to come to that quite naturally, that being the topic this evening, of just what we mean by happiness. Are we to be sad and depressed? Are we to go around with long faces, very serious, you see? Because theosophy, of course, is serious business. But simply because it is serious business, it is also to be borne lightly. It is so serious that we must not have long faces about it. We must be joyous in our understandings of ourselves and of the concepts of the theosophical worldview. It's interesting historically, and I'm not going to give you a lesson in history tonight, heaven forbid, But it's interesting historically that one of the basic ideas that came into full expression in the 18th century was the notion that happiness is the natural right of every human being, the natural right of man. In the Age of Enlightenment, which took, of course, reason as its guide, the concept of inevitable progress became dominant, onward and upward forever. And that concept included the idea that happiness was not a state of some future ill-defined heaven condition, which had been the concept of happiness up until that time, but it was the natural present condition of man on earth, of incarnation. I would like to refer, for example, to some of the discussion this afternoon. The discussion about, you know, what is the self and the image of the self? In the sense that we must recognize the great challenge and the tremendous opportunity that it is to have personalities. The challenge of incarnation. We cannot overlook this because we are told, and it seems very evident and very apparent, that every step in spiritual growth is taken in physical incarnation. This is a primary concept presented to us in the Secret Doctrine. It's a primary concept of the Eastern philosophy, that every step is taken in physical incarnation. It is here that is the great challenge, the challenge of incarnation. The most precious thing the ego, or the monad, if you like, ever possesses is a personality capable of expressing it fully, happily, joyously, and with a radiance that becomes a beneficent influence and presence in the world. And so this concept that happiness was the natural right of man became, it is said, the fundamental heresy of the Age of Enlightenment. The doctrine that man is naturally good, and therefore because he is naturally good, his happiness is his inherent right. The doctrine, of course, came to be interpreted, that particular concept, to mean that we do have certain natural rights, that just by virtue of being human, there are rights that belong to our natural being. It's interesting to observe, again historically, that perhaps this was given clearest expression in the document which established the independence of my own country, the Declaration of Independence, as it is known, which was written, of course, against a philosophical background of the Age of Enlightenment by Englishmen. That's why I can refer to it in New Zealand. It was written not by Americans, because there were no Americans as such then, at least except for the American Indian. It was written by Englishmen steeped in this fundamental doctrine of the goodness of man. And so in that document, the Declaration of Independence, propounded, as I say, by a group of very well-educated and philosophically inclined Englishmen who conceived the idea of a republic which could work together in harmony, in close cooperation. And in that document they wrote that man has certain inalienable rights, among which are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Now this right to pursue happiness soon became interpreted then as a political right. And this has become dominant in all of the political democracies of the world today. It is written, for example, even into the constitution of the modern nation of Turkey, when Turkey became a modern nation around 1920. It is expressly stated in their constitution, and it has very much influenced all political structures of the democratic world since the Age of Enlightenment. It was therefore given a political interpretation, a right that was guaranteed, for example, in a number of political documents the constitutions, for example, of every one of the 50 states of the United States contains within it a reference to the right of the human being to pursue, and in some cases, the statement is made, to pursue and obtain happiness. When I tell this to some of my fellow countrymen, you see, they say, you know, do we have a right to sue the state then if we have not obtained happiness? And that, of course, must follow. Well, not only was this right to pursue happiness reflected in political documents, but it influenced the judicial system of all of the democracies of the Western world. During, particularly, again, out of the Age of Enlightenment. It was the great English jurist, William Blackstone, whose work, of course, formed the basis for much of jurisprudence throughout the Western democratic world. And he suggested, indeed, that the one paternal precept dictated by God himself, and therefore a natural law, is simply that man should pursue his own happiness. You may wonder why I'm stressing all of this, but I hope it will become apparent, because it's into this kind of situation that the Theosophical Society was ultimately brought to birth. Within that context, you see, first a political right, then a legal right. But by the end of the 19th century, when scientific materialism, as we know, had reached its zenith, and the Darwinian concept of the survival of the fittest seemed to be unchallenged, the concept of happiness was changed into a social and economic right of man. Again, time does, of course, not permit, nor is it my intention to give you a full lesson in history as to how this has come about. But it's rather interesting to observe, and I think that as members of the society, as students of the Theosophical philosophy, we should be familiar with the development of many of these concepts, because it was into this kind of milieu, into this kind of context, that the Theosophical philosophy was rooted in order to bring a new meaning to all of these ideas that had been so influential and continue to be influential in the thinking of humanity. And so happiness, indeed, by the end of the last century, for much of the Western world, had become a corporate concern, since the survival of the fittest not only applied to the biological sphere of life, but was extended to every field of human endeavor, most notably economic affairs. But around the turn of the century, another force in human thought began to make itself felt in the Western world. Again, at the risk of oversimplifying history, since that's not my intention, we may note that numerous forces converged around the turn of the century to impel man to look at himself and at his fellow man, at himself and at his brothers. A number of factors. The science, in fact, the science of psychology was really born. No longer the public life and of politics, of economics, science, law, but the inner life of emotion, of instinct, impulse, response became the sphere where felicity should reign. The roots of happiness, in other words, were transferred from the world of the political philosopher, the economist and jurist, to the world of the doctor, the psychiatrist, and the social psychologist. The ancient doctrine, a fundamental doctrine in thought, which in the Western world we can trace certainly to Plato, if not to his predecessor Pythagoras, that happiness was living in accordance with the harmony of one's nature and with the universe about him, was no longer defined in terms of that nature as defined originally by Newton and Darwin. But now the problem of happiness was seen as the problem of adjustment between our primitive subliminal urges of our hidden selves, our own external nature, and the drab practical necessities of everyday life. Happiness, in other words, came to be expressed and continues to be expressed in terms of the individual's liberation from the confines of a social code. And consequently today, we are witnessing in our very midst a revolution in moral and ethical standards. Disturbing, perhaps, unless we can begin to understand what is involved and speak directly to the questions that are being raised. I think that we owe very, very much to the young people of today who have the courage to speak up in terms of a moral and ethical code that derives from an interior integrity and honesty, essential honesty, and integrity of self. And I think this is something that we very much owe to the new generation, if I may call them that, that have come on the scene, particularly in the last 30 years, since the 1950s, really, in a recognition of this. The pursuit of happiness has moved then and become the individual's right to be free from group-imposed ethics and standards. This is highly significant, I suggest, to us as theosophical students, members of an organization whose platform has always been independent search and inquiry. Indeed, H.P. Blavatsky suggested that the theosophical student is the intrepid pioneer in the realm of thought, of independent study and inquiry, and that unless he is willing to undertake his own independent study, to follow, therefore, in the footsteps of those who have indeed realized to the full their own individuality and realized it in terms of incarnation, in the challenge and the burden of accepting incarnation, unless we are willing to follow in their footsteps, not blindly, but exploring for ourselves what it means to be a full, a total person, and therefore happy, that we are not worthy of the name theosophists. And I think this is as strong a statement as H.P. Blavatsky ever made, that we are indeed these pioneers. Are we willing to explore the concepts and to do so happily? Well, returning then to this kind of historical survey, we can see that in less than two centuries, the concept of happiness moved from the idea that it was a natural right because to be human involved happiness, inherent happiness, alignment to in accordance with the law of one's own being, to the idea that unhappiness is the product of faulty hormones, buried psychic traumas, a childhood psychologically unsatisfactory, and a whole complex of unfortunate personal relationships, so that we, even within the theosophical society, begin to look at each other and say, "You are making me unhappy." And if only so-and-so wasn't in the lodge, or if only so-and-so would act differently, or vote the way I think so-and-so should vote. You see, happiness cannot reign. So we ourselves are often caught up in this very same pattern, the neurotic and psychotic misery of our time. We cannot retreat, then, into some safe realm where we say, well, all that matters is the higher self. Because, my dear friends, there is only one self. And that self may act in a multitude of ways, some of which we may ascribe as lower than other aspects, and some as higher. But there is only one self. Let us forget the duality which has so long characterized our thinking, the Cartesian duality of which I spoke last evening. And we persist in it. We talk about my higher self as though it were something divorced from that which we really are. There is one self. And realizing there is one self which can act in a multitude of ways, we can naturally begin to move ultimately. And this is true happiness, as I hope to suggest in a little while. We can begin to move to the fact that not only is there one self which acts through the complexity of my functioning in the world, but there is only one self acting in the multitude of ways which we call individuals and all sentient existences. But we cannot move to that ultimate one self if we persist in dividing ourselves into a higher and a lower, a higher mind and a lower mind. There is but one manas, only one mind. And we are rooted in that. We are fundamentally rooted in consciousness, in manas. This is where man is man, where we are ourselves individual. And so one universal mind, which has many ways of expression. And I think we have to learn, therefore, that kind of language that will abolish these dualities and recognize all of these as means by which we can come to that interior mode of functioning which is in complete harmony with the one universal mind, the one universal consciousness. This, of course, was pointed to in the ancient Vedas. This is nothing that is new, although it has had its expression in new manner in the Western tradition to which I've been referring. But in the ancient Vedas, it was spoken of as ritta, a very interesting word that had to do with order, with a cosmic order that is imprinted in the very nature of every individual and indeed in every sentient being. Later, in the Upanishadic literature, as that developed out of the Vedic literature, the oldest literature in the world as we know, this came to be divided, and it's interesting, this dualism that arose, for example, in the Eastern philosophic tradition. And it became divided as two principles, karma and dharma. We spend a lot of time on karma, of course, in the Theosophical Society, particularly if anything unhappy happens to us, if anything dreadful happens to us. We spend an awful lot of time on karma, you know. I think I may have said this when I was here before, but I'll repeat it. It's still one of my favorite ideas, that we all, you know, we do sound very often like a batch of parrots. Maybe peacocks would be better. But parrots, you know, that anything that goes wrong, well, it's your karma, it's your karma, it's your karma sort of thing. And this is what we go on saying, you see, without realizing that behind this and equal with it is a concept which developed alongside it of dharma, that which sustains, which nourishes, because the very word dharma from the root Sanskrit term dhi, which is to sustain, to nourish, to hold, to maintain, and in that orderliness. These are the dual ways in which that cosmic pattern of the Vedic concept of ritta operates. Can we begin to live in accordance with this? Can we begin to see that this is our very nature? So that however we function, it is the one self functioning. Well, nowhere, therefore, has this condition that I'm calling happiness, and I haven't come to a definition of it as yet, as you'll please note, because today we are becoming aware that there are some other factors certainly involved. It lies not in escape from ourselves or from our surroundings, certainly not in political documents nor court decisions, but in moments of penetration into our own nature, into our own being. There is genuine happiness. in that loss of self, which is the complete being of self. Again, the paradox, one of the paradoxes to which I referred last evening. It's not something, happiness is not something then that is added to life or existence, not even a possession, which we may be fortunate enough to own. But I would call it that deep, abiding current of life, a state of continuing contentment with things as they are. Because we know that as they are, in their purity, in their essence, in their utter nature, their naked nature, they are part of that great cosmic order we may call the divine plan, Ritta, as the Vedas call it. Well, nowhere has that condition been more accurately defined than in the 5th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, in which Sri Krishna instructs Arjuna about the reconciliation of the two paths which he presented to Arjuna, the path of renunciation and the path of action. How can we tread, as it were, two ways at once? And this, of course, was Arjuna's real problem. Each one of us, of course, being Arjuna, because each one of us is like Arjuna, simply, all Arjuna was a man with a problem. That's really all he was, a man with a problem. He was very fortunate in recognizing that there was a teacher available, his charioteer, that which drove him between the two battling armies. And so there in the 5th chapter, Sri Krishna tells him what is the integrated individual who knows both renunciation of action and action. Because act we must. And of course that is the final lesson of the Gita, as you may know, in the 18th chapter, a marvelous lesson, that we must act. To be human is to act. As in the play this morning, inaction in a deed of mercy is action in a deadly sin. It is action. It is man's being to act. We act, do we not? You may say, oh no, I'm just, sitting, doing nothing, but that is acting. And so the final lesson, as we know, of the Gita is Sri Krishna simply telling Arjuna, act because it is the nature of being human to act, even though every action is clouded as though by smoke. A marvelous statement which is there. You can look it up. I'm not quoting it exactly correctly, but clouded. It is clouded because it has its repercussions. It has its resonance, if you like, throughout the whole universe. Because as the poet very beautifully put it, thou canst not pick a flower without the troubling of a star. The resonance is throughout the whole universe. But in the 5th chapter of the Gita, Sri Krishna helps Arjuna to understand what is the integrated individual, the individual who has learned that he acts at the same time that he renounces the fruit of his action. And he says it very simply. He whose self is unattached to external contacts and findeth joy in the self, having the self harmonized with the eternal by yoga, that individual enjoys imperishable bliss. And then he follows that definition with this beautiful statement, which I think is the key to what we are seeking here. He who is able to endure here on earth, ere he be liberated from the body, the force born from desire and passion, he is harmonized. He is a happy man. That is happiness. He who is able to endure here on earth the challenge of incarnation, as I call it, being willing to accept incarnation joyously, happily, to be here, to be present here in the world. He who is able to endure here on earth, ere he be liberated from the body, the force born from desire and passion. Not getting rid of it, you know. I realize that in some of the texts, the injunction is given to kill out various things. And I suggest that this is the kind of Eastern hyperbole that acts as what I call the psychological accelerator of our own atomic fission. Yes, it blows us apart in order that there can be reconstituted that immortal self. And so we are indeed, in fact, that's what yoga is. It's a psychological accelerator which is bombarding, in which the whole structure that we have built up through the ages is now being bombarded by that force which is ever present in the universe, force born from desire and passion. No, we do not kill out desire. We merely redirect it when we emerge from the psychological accelerator, which is yoga, if you like. And I'm trying to put it in contemporary terms because I think we have to speak in terms that are used today. Why not? Every generation writes its own truths in its own language. The Master K.H. said as much to Mr. Sinnott, that every generation must rewrite the knowledge for itself and relearn the wisdom in its own manner. Truth always is spoken by a human tongue. And what is the tongue that we speak with today? And so it is not the destruction, but the redirection. Because we are also advised to desire that which is eternal, which is imperishable. And so the force that is born of this passion, which brought into being universes, countless universes, this was the passion of a logos. And if we are to be logoi in the becoming, as it has been suggested, if we are in training for that which is more than man, then we had better learn to be human first. For we can scarcely be more than human until we have become human. For those who, you know, like to say, well, I have no use for the mind. I go beyond the mind. I like to tell them that you need a mind to go beyond. For man was never meant to be mindless. And the secret doctrine tells us very much what happened with those individuals who were mindless and got us all into trouble, you know, somewhere. That was, you know, we on our way to developing the mind. But that passion of the Logos that can produce, can create, can bring into being a whole system, a universe with all that is living and moving within it, part of the life of that logoic entity, that logoic consciousness. If we ourselves are not gripped by that passion to be human, then we scarcely deserve to be in the human stage. And this is why, you know, in most of the texts, it is said that this is the most precious gift, our humanity. As Plato said, therefore, with what care should we take care of the soul, precious as it is? This was the lesson of Nagarjuna in the Mahayana tradition of Tsongkhapa, to whom HPB refers on many occasions in the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. To be human is so precious it can be lost. Yes, of course we may continue to walk around on 2 feet and look like humans. You know, have the appearance of humans. But we are not human unless we act in a human manner. And this, of course, is the teaching in all of the great scriptures, really, to be truly, fully human. And therefore, to endure here on earth the force born from desire and passion, to channel it, to use it. He who can do that, said Sri Krishna, he is harmonized. He is a happy man. Now this, of course, means, as has already been said, he whose self is unattached to external context. That is to say, does not any longer identify himself with everything with which he comes in touch. He is free. He knows the nature of true freedom. We prate of freedom of thought within the Theosophical Society. By and large, it's not freedom of thought at all. It's simply liberty of anybody's opinion. And it's simply freedom of opinion. And we share our ignorance. And we delight in sharing our ignorance, you know, again and again. Freedom of thought means a mind that can be free, a mind that is not attached, a mind that is pure, that is established in its own harmony, that is moved from within by that passion which is buddhi. Buddhi is not simply, you know, oh, we like to say intuition, and we generally stress the wish more than anything else. It's what we wish it to be. Or we translate it as love, and we say, you know, in our sickly sentimental ways in theosophy, you know, I'm being very rude to you all, I realize this, you know, but we become very sentimental, and you know, I love everybody, you know, I love people, of course it's you I can't stand in the lodge. But I love humanity, and I can sit in quiet meditation all by myself, you know, sending love to the world. But oh, at the lodge meetings. It's so easy to love the world in the privacy of our own meditation chambers, isn't it? You see, it's when we get out, when we have to jostle somebody on a streetcar or a tram or whatever you call them down here, you know, or, you know, we have to drive a little bit faster on the road. We have to pass everybody up. Why are these stupid people driving? They shouldn't be permitted to drive, you know, because they can't drive and so on. All the rest, you see. I mean, let's be honest about it. And so, can we, in such a condition, be unattached from external contacts? And if we are not, can we have a mind that is free? Freedom is not easy. Freedom is the most difficult of all of the, shall I call them, all of the qualities that we may be able to achieve. We become so attached to our ideas, and that's an external contact. You know, it's not simply being attached to food, as theosophists, all of us are, of course. I mean, why are we lined up at the door 3 times, 5 times a day, you know, if we weren't? It's very easy, you know, but we're attached to ideas. It becomes my idea. Is the mind free? Can we be a happy man, a harmonized individual, when there is that kind of attachment, where there is something reserved? You know, take everything else away, but don't take that away. Please don't disturb that idea. Well, to come to this condition then, this condition of an interior harmony, a freedom, a genuine freedom, in which we can begin to know, begin to explore the boundaries of thought, is indeed the psychology of happiness. This is what we can come to. I think often of that very wonderful story in the Christian tradition the biblical story of the man who was brought to Jesus, you remember, who was sick of the palsy. You remember the story. And Jesus said to him, you see, then when Jesus was called out and said to him, he spoke with the authority, of course, that immediately awakened the dormant consciousness of that man. And there is that within us. That, of course, if you like, is the Atman within, which has the authority if we will listen, but it cannot be heard above the chattering mind. It cannot be heard above the attachments of our emotions and prejudices and likes and dislikes and all of that. But when it can pierce through to that sleeping individual, the man sick with palsy, for what does that mean? Simply sick with fear, anxiety, shaking with the fear of being in incarnation. And yet that command came, arise, take up thy bed, and go unto thine house. He who can do that is the happy man to whom Sri Krishna referred. He is the awake man. The story concludes, of course, as you recall, with the healing of the man. But why did such a healing occur? First, because he was willing to obey the voice of the immortal self. That means he could hear that voice, but he could obey. Obedience is part of this concept in the Vedas of Rita. Obedience to that which is the cosmic order, that everything is as it should be. This was a hard lesson, and it still continues to be a hard lesson, you know. But HPB, in teaching her pupils, her select group of students around her in the final years of her life, presented them with a diagram of meditation, which some of you may have seen. It's published, of course, and available. But in that, she suggested to her students that that kind of consciousness, which is established in a realization of the order of all things, gives rise to a continuing, what she called the continuing presence of courage. Because there is the courage of one's being. And it's a continual presence. And it arises out of that obedience to the cosmic order. That act of obedience to the self is the first step in turning toward instead of away from life, which means going into one's own house. Go unto thine house, was the commandment. But before that, what had to happen? Arise, take up thy bed. Well, how easy it would be, you know, if we could simply leave the bed we have made behind us for somebody else. It would be marvelous if there were karmic scavengers coming after us to sweep up, you know, all the things that we really shouldn't have done, that we don't like to face anymore. But there are no karmic scavengers in the inner worlds, no vultures to sweep down and take up the bones. We ourselves must take up our own beds. And we take them into our own house. We do not leave them. In other words, we have to take ourselves as we are. We have to confront all that we ever have been, all that we have made of ourselves. We leave nothing behind. And so it is said that the adept is one who has disentangled all the threads of his own past and rewoven them into a new consciousness. We would like to, of course, to step into adepthood at once, easily, you know, It would be so nice if somebody would come along. And of course, for a price today, you can get this. I realize that, you know. It's a little more expensive than joining the Theosophical Society. But there are those who will confer instant enlightenment. And of course, we like everything instant. I notice that even in England, God forbid, they're using tea bags, you know. We can't stand to brew the stuff from, you know, leaves. We have tea bags now. You know, I remember when they first started in the United States and Clara Codd was with us, and of course immediately dubbed them the drowned mice of thing. These tea bags, horrible things. But we like everything instant today, our instant meals, and therefore why not instant enlightenment, you see. And there are the gurus and pseudo-gurus, you see, that offer you instant enlightenment. And of course the main emphasis is on lightening you of all the money that you have, so that you can't, after all, take that with you. But here is the ancient commandment. And this is happiness. This is the joyous adventure in which we have engaged ourselves. I think all too frequently, when we come to the Theosophical Society, we say, I have it made. I have found it now. You know, this is it. And we rejoice. And of course, then we want to shout it from the rooftops and all the rest. Because it would be happier, it'd be much easier, if all the world were theosophists, wouldn't it? Except it would be boring, you know. Deadly boring, and I'd be out of a job of traveling because everybody would already be converted, and it's not much fun speaking to the converted, except I'm speaking to you and being very rude, as I say, but trying in that way to perhaps shock you a little bit. But we come to it with this kind of finality, and we never move again, and our ideas never change, and we become rigid. We, in fact, retreat into the mineral kingdom. Solid rock. Never to be, you know, changed again somehow. And we cling to this steadfastly. I think coming to the Theosophical Society, coming to Theosophy, is just the very beginning of the glorious adventure of knowing. That constant call, arise, take up thy bed, and enter thine own house. This is a constant call. And if we do it, it is a happy adventure. It may not be easy. It may be disturbing at times, you see. Is karma just what we think it is? Is reincarnation, you know, just one life after another ad nauseam ad infinitum? And suddenly we step out into some glorious nirvanic condition of adeptship. Do we realize, even from a cursory reading of that great correspondence, the Mahatma letters, the struggle that continues? The Master Cage, for example, writing that he had to study for 25 years before he could come to the doctrine of cycles. Oh, we want to get to it right away, don't we? And the statement that they are still working just to maintain their place within the ranks of the hierarchy. So I suggest that this is what we can mean by a psychology of happiness. There is very much more that we could say about it. I venture to suggest that we are in this unique position today that we can change the world if we will. The Theosophical Society, I propose to you, was born in the last century in order that it would be here in this century. That it would be that worldwide instrument through which a certain atmosphere, a certain flavor could be given to the consciousness of humanity. Are we giving it? Are we measuring up to that. We have a tremendous legacy. We have inherited a tremendous bequest, this ageless wisdom, only a portion of which, remember, was given to us. There is far more to be known. But will we ourselves come to grips with it? The psychology of happiness, I suggest, is simply this kind of adventure. To be willing at all points to endure, yes, what one writer has called the hell of our refusals, and to turn them into the heavens of our I saying, yes saying, self-affirmation, one self, one universal mind, one consciousness into which we have, in which we are rooted, and therefore into which we can pour that bliss, that imperishable bliss of the universal one.